But what I'm going to be talking about is work that John Kogut and I have been doing for the past few years, and that is simulating a QCD, not at a finite quark number density, but we're adopting a very old tradition in theoretical physics. If you're interested in the problem but you don't know how to solve it, you go to a different problem that you do know how to deal with, and that'll be QCD at finite chemical potential mu sub I, not to be confused with imaginary quark number chemical potential, which tends to use the same symbolism for isospin. And of course, it's really a chemical potential for the third component of isospin. I won't go through the arguments as to why we're all interested in QCD at finite density, in particular QCD at finite quark number density, because I think that's been adequately covered here. And anyway, we're all supposed to be cognoscenti and know why people are interested in this. Well, what does the QCD at finite isospin chemical potential phase diagram? And we're interested in not only finite chemical potential, we're interested also in finite temperature, and we're studying that regime which everybody is interested in, that is somewhere near the finite temperature transition and coming out here into the mu I plane. Well, you know, for two flavors and for three flavors, yes, I will admit three flavors here is a little bit strange. It means three halves of an up quark and three halves of down quark, but really that's just dealing with three flavors with the magnitude of the quark number of the determinant for finite mu, in other words, finite quark number chemical potential. But for two flavors and for three flavors with high enough quark mass, this is just transition is just a crossover, and what you find is that the crossover temperature decreases rather slowly with increasing chemical potential. You know, by the time you get to chemical potentials of a couple of hundred, one or 200 MeV, this has only fallen by about 10 MeV from its initial point, which is what, 175 MeV. So it's pretty gradual fall off. You also, yes? Sure. Well, this one, I'm just about to tell you where the interesting thing happens, say down at zero temperature, and that is that at mu I equals m pi. Oh yes, this is the mu I is m. That's because now the chemical potential favors large isospin, and the best, cheapest way to make isospin is to make pions. Okay, at m pi, there starts a transition. Now at zero temperature, we know that the transition appears to be second order with mean field critical exponents. This levels off at some place where there is, in fact, a finite temperature transition. This time, this is a real phase transition, because in this regime, isospin, or the third component of isospin, the only remaining piece of isospin once you add this chemical potential, is broken spontaneously in this regime by a charged pion condensate. And here and above here, you're in the quark-gluon plasma where that condensate goes away. So this is a genuine transition. And then somehow these things presumably join together. No, but you've broken, since it's a chemical potential for I3, the third component of isospin, is conserved normally. Still remains a good symmetry. I3 remains a good symmetry. In this regime, I3 is spontaneously broken. Once you add, I'll show you what the Hamiltonian or the action is in a moment. As I say, in a moment I will put down the actual action. The action, the interaction with chemical potential in the continuum will look like something like D slash plus M, and then there'd be plus this gamma zero, let's put it mu I, gamma zero, but instead of just gamma zero, there would be a tau 3 acting in isospin space. But I3 is. I3 commutes with that. Yes. So I3 is still conserved. So there's a U1 symmetry associated with tau 3. What's broken is tau 3. The condensate is in the direction of one of the other taus, the space made by tau 1 and tau 2. Sure. What's happening essentially is when you get to a certain stage with this type of chemical potential, if you think of finite temperature as making the lattice with 1 over t in the time direction, that once you get, in fact, to a certain, this value m pi, then this mu I actually takes your pion propagator and reduces the effective mass there by an amount mu I. So when mu I equals m pi, all of a sudden the excitation becomes massless. That's the Goldstone boson. And you get pion excitations which wrap round and round and round the lattice. Yes. Yeah. Maybe if I put down what the action looks, and I'll put it down in a staggered quark lattice action, you'll get some idea. That's right. And the orthogonal set of pions are the Goldstone bosons. They become really massless, even though the quark mass is finite.
I3
is
a big I3 that
is yes. Pi plus and pi minus are the finite I3. With some linear combination of pi 1 and pi 2. Yeah, one of them. The symmetry is the symmetry that's being generated by essentially something that, by multiplying by one side e to the minus, say, I lambda tau 3. key to the island of Tal 3. So I'm sure with your hammer. The symmetry associated with rotating in the 1-2 plane. 1-2 plane, because it'll choose one direction. The condensate will choose one particular direction in that plane. The orthogonal direction will be the Goldstone boson. And once you've got, a condensate of pi pluses, then pi minuses will be massless, and the isospin symmetry will be broken because... All right. And then, now we decided about this regime and that. The question, of course, comes as to whether, before you reach here, whether you have one of these infamous critical endpoints. And if we do have one of those critical endpoints, is it indeed related to the critical endpoint at finite mu? Well, what we'd noticed when we did this for two flavors was that indeed you did have that this transition here appeared to be just a crossover all the way to here, and the fall off with increasing chemical potential appeared to be almost identical to the rate of fall off with finite quark number chemical potential, which tells you that somehow in this regime the phase of the fermion determinant, which is what distinguishes the two, seems to be relatively unimportant. The real question is, if it's unimportant for the position of the transition, is it also unimportant for the nature of the transition? That is, if there's a critical endpoint here at finite mu I, is there a critical endpoint at finite mu and vice versa? And this is a standard critical endpoint. So over here you'll see a jump in psi bar psi, you will see a jump in the Polyakov loop, anything else that is not constrained to change smoothly across the transition. So say it's the same idea as the critical endpoint at finite quark number chemical or baryon number chemical potential that we've been talking about here. Numerically, we did not for the case NF equals 2. There does not appear, we didn't see this. And that doesn't, of course, necessarily mean that it doesn't exist at finite mu, meaning quark number chemical potential. Okay, let me just write down the action so that it'll make it some place to start off with. And this is in the lattice form, and I have in mind doing it for staggered chairs all around here. I have it in for staggered quarks, so I'll have something like this chi bar, where that's the staggered fermion field. Have a d slashed, and this will be of a half mu I tau 3, and I'll tell you what that means, plus m. Maybe I should make this one different. And, you know, in the same way as if you want to look at breaking down of chiral symmetry, you put in a small mass term and then take it away. But in this case, you put in a small term which explicitly breaks Tao 3. Which is, and these Taos act on an internal internal flavor space. And this, as you can see, having a Tao 2 in it explicitly breaks that. And so the type of condensate that we will get will be something proportional to that. So we've chosen, the fact that we have a Tau 2 and a Tau, instead of a Tau 1 there, is the thing that that picks our direction in the U1 symmetry is associated with Tau 3. The epsilon, this is because I know you will hate the fact, but we use staggered fermions, and so in staggered fermions, this epsilon is just minus 1 to the x plus y plus z plus t. It's the typical thing that puts in effectively the gamma 5 for staggered fermions. Okay, so if we... Now, why do we think things might be a little bit different for any... So, sure. Yes, you need the I in order to make the thing Hermitian. It's the usual I gamma 5. Okay. Anyway. Two flavor components. So that would mean, of course, with staggered fermions, until you do a little bit of tuning, this thing would have 8 flavors. But of course, then we play the flavor tuning trick, which will upset Herbert no end, but we do it. And what was that? Yes, we take a fourth root. Or actually, fourth root. See if this will change. Okay, so then what happens when you go to finite temperature I have described? But let's see, why is it that we're interested now in going to NF equals 3? Well, the reason of that is not only because, of course, it's closer to the real world, but also what you know at NF equals 3 in terms of that there is a value mass of the quark mass such that the quark mass less than mc, the finite temperature transition is first order, while for m greater than mc, the finite temperature transition is just a crossover. While for m equals the critical mass, this is second order, and people have argued that it should be in the universality class of the 3D Ising model. So then you know information about it. Then what people have argued then is say, well, we know also that this critical endpoint has been argued to be in the Ising equivalence class. Maybe these two are related, and that the position of your let me see what plane I'm dealing with. Okay, if m is mc, we are. This is at mu I equals 0. For m greater than mc, we're supposed to be in a region where there is just a crossover in this region, the first order, then the suggestion is, well, how does this point move as you go out in the plane? Well, this, they feel the obvious suggestion is that it curves up in some fashion, and then if you were to move, instead of moving up and down in mass, if you were to move across at a fixed mass just above the critical mass and increase mu I with everything else fixed, eventually you would cross the value of this line, at which your transition here would be a crossover, and in this regime, because it's now in this regime, it would be here, it would be first order. So that this would be the critical end point. So that's the argument. And the nice thing about that argument, of course, is that it suggests that by tuning the value of the mass, I can find this critical end point as close as I like to mu I equals zero. And that's rather important in this case, because that way I can arrange, or should be able to arrange, for it to be less than m pi. Also, when you look at the fluctuations of the phase of the fermion determinant, they become less and less as you move towards mu I, to fermion determinant for the corresponding theory at finite mu, the fluctuations in phase become less and less as you go to that point. And so the suggestion is that if you can move it into that regime, you should be able to see the same critical end point at both finite mu and finite mu I. Of course, finite mu I we know how to do. So that's what we've been trying to deal with. Well, what was is known by earlier work by people. No, I didn't say it was, but I said that is the argument that people have been, the idea being that, okay, so what happens to this? Well, it's a nice, this is a nice Ising point, there'll be a line. I should ask you guys whether you can, whoever predicts these behaviors from fairly general arguments, whether you can guess how it would go. Yes, it may be a problem. And of course, so there people have been trying this. Philippe and have been trying it, and the Bielefeld-Swansea collaboration have been looking for this, and they both claim that they actually see some evidence for a critical end point, but they're not quite sure that they actually agree where it is. And there are other people like Fodor and Katz who have been looking for such critical end points by their advanced reweighting schemes, and they claim, and I think theirs is somewhere else again, if it's possible to make a simple thing. I'm asking Philippe. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. So then it goes, okay, so it goes, yeah, well, we probably should ask ourselves what would happen at imaginary mu sub I. Yeah, this is all three quarks degenerate. I mean, it doesn't have to be that way, but of course that makes it easier to do the simulation and you have one less parameter to vary, which when you're doing these simulations. What was that? No, what we're doing, as I said, the three flavors that we have, as I said at the beginning, are 1.5 up quarks and 1.5 down quarks. That just means that we're working with the magnitude of the fermion determinant. And anyway, that's the theory that you could, the only theory you'd have any chance of arguing could be similar to the theory at finite mu, finite quark number chemical potential, three flavors. What was that? Work with four? Well, that's not clear. You can make the mass high. You should be able to make the mass high enough. If you make the mass high enough with four flavors, you should also be able to make the thing go to a crossover. Four flavors. Or at least the very early attempts seem to indicate that. I'm not sure what the state of the art was. Yes. Anyway, so that anyway is the argument, and what we've been doing is just simulating the situation, and I didn't have any idea, but Philippe claims that, of course, they work. Say we're at finite mu. Finite mu. Because here we're trying to argue whether what would happen if finite mu and finite mu I are similar. Now, he claims that at finite mu, let's make it mu squared, that when you go below here, that this in fact continues to go on down, and so therefore in finite mu it's close to being, in terms of mu squared it's close to, should be close to being a straight line at least, but close enough. Here he claims that you can see that what the slope is here, and you know that the slope here has to go down as you go more negative, and therefore if you just continue on through here, that would suggest that it is going up. Okay, well then probably I should, what we've been doing. No. We do have some hand-waving arguments that probably for small enough chemical potentials, that is chemical potentials much less than m pi, that these two theories should behave somewhat similarly. Okay. And appear to behave somewhat similarly in the position of the transition. The question is whether it's also in the nature of the transition. Okay, well, in order to actually figure out where the not only where the transition is, but what the nature of the transition is, we've been using the infamous fourth order Bind accumulants, and what the fourth order Bind accumulant, at least in the definition we're using, is for some observable x, the Bind accumulant of x is defined as being the expectation value, this is the fourth order Bind accumulant, expectation value of the fourth order fluctuation, and this is of the quantity summed over the lattice, in other words, integrated over space, over the finite volume, over expectation value of x minus expectation of x. In other words, the quadratic fluctuation all squared. What you know in continuum limit is that for a simple crossover in the continuum, so crossover, is over in the continuum. This goes to, has a value 3 for the case of a first order. The Binda-cumulant has the value 1, and for the Ising critical point, it's 1.604 with an error of 1 in that last digit. So, what? 3D Ising, yes. Well, the 4D Ising, it would be its mean field again. Yeah. It's a crossover, and then it becomes first order. Since there's no continuous symmetry that's being restored, then people believe that the transition should be that the end point where the first order goes to transitions to a crossover should be a critical point, and that critical point, since it doesn't have any obvious continuous symmetries associated with it, they assume that its universality class is the ID to Ising. What was what a, the number 3 for the crossover? It's just Gaussian. It's just what you get from. Of course, that's an infinite that's infinite volume, but what you happen want to see in a finite volume is if something's going to be a crossover, it will in general be above this value, and if it's going to a first order transition, it will lie below that value. And so what usually you see if you do a large number of volumes and you actually have a transition to, it's not, I don't need the bottom part of that, so move this down. Here I'd have my Ising value, and say the point of interest is here. What you would notice if you were varying temperature is that for relatively small volumes, you'd get something like this that go through there. As you go to larger volumes, it goes through more steeply until, of course, you, in infinite volume, it would do that. That's the type of behaviors. And so what you start looking for is you look for having different volumes cross at a given point, and for the crossing point to be the Ising value. What am I plotting here? I'm plotting whatever the order, this B4, whatever the most relevant order parameter is. And in this case, it's close to being the chiral condensate. And I'm plotting it again, or in fact, in this case, it would be beta. You know, my beta is 6 over G squared. Which is the way that you vary temperature on the lattice. It would be something like, now I may have that going in the wrong direction, it may be going this direction or that. That doesn't matter particularly. But so what we'll actually look at is actually look at Binda, we want to look at Binda cumulants, and but before that, what I should show you is some indication as to how quantities and these transitions go as a function of temperature or beta, in fact, in this case, at a fixed mu, and show you how the transition actually moves. Okay, well, we have to get down, and maybe I shouldn't look into the what you'll actually see is if you plot something like the, that case, the Polyakov loop, what happens is that under it has a very rapid crossover. I thought I saw a pointer. Yes, I did. It has a very rapid crossover somewhere about here. And if you want to define the position of a crossover, the best way to do it is just to look for peaks in susceptibilities. Or in fact, it turns out that with these bindercumulants, if you look for the minimum value of the bindercumulant, you get essentially the same. You get essentially the same value for the critical crossover, the position of the crossover, and it appears to be fairly independent of which observable you have. That's a non-trivial statement, of course, for a crossover, because it doesn't necessarily have a very definite position. So that's what it looks like. The important thing to notice is that, in fact, the beta is going down as the chemical potential increases. It's not going down very fast, and that means that it's going down in beta means it's actually going down in temperature. I don't think so, because the thing is, there are theories with the same universality class which actually have different values of the fourth order bindercumulant, because it also depends on the dimension of the order parameter. But if you want, from that you can actually find out how the crossover beta depends on mu I squared. And this graph here, that this line here in fact turns out to, although this is at finite mu I, if I make the identification that mu, 2 mu equals mu sub I, that 2 just comes from the factor of a half that I have in front of the tau 3. If you make that identification and look at that particular line and compare it with the corresponding line obtained by Philippe and Hervé, you in fact find there's excellent agreement. So that's the first piece of evidence that there is some connection between the finite mu I and the finite mu behavior of the transition. Now, when we looked at the bindercumulants, one of the things that confused us earlier is the fact that first we seem to find evidence for one of these critical endpoints, but there we assumed that the bindercumulant would not have much dependence on the time increment in the updating, used in the updating for the algorithm we use, with the hybrid molecular dynamics algorithm, which is an inexact algorithm used in order to calculate this. However, then when we came to suspect that there was something not quite right, we actually started looking at the DT dependence of the bindercumulant. And DT is just the increment used in these molecular dynamics updates. You will notice that it changes quite considerably over a range of DT between, I think this is 0.0625 and this is 0.025 in our particular units. And you notice that not only does it change, but it also changes over that range from a value that's below the Ising point. So it looks sort of first order, to by the time you go to small enough DTs, it's clearly way above the Ising point, so it is probably a crossover. And unfortunately, of course, if you go to finite mu sub I, the further you go, the closer you are to this famous boundary, which is hidden from sight at mass of the pion, and things in fact become more singular, so you need to go to smaller DTs. What? Possibly. I say possibly because I'm not sure how RDT corresponds, how closely RDT corresponds to theirs. Having worked in a larger collaboration where there were three groups that were put together in the collaboration and they had three different definitions of DT which differed by each root two relative to others, so the two extrema differed by a factor of two. The other thing is, which differs from what you guys do, is because we work at these real chemical potentials, we cannot separate odd and even lattices. They're connected by the interaction, so you have to have fermions on all sides of the lattice, not every other one. That means that instead of taking the three-quarter power of this fermion determinant, you're actually taking the three-eighths power. So it's very difficult to do a direct comparison, but it would be interesting. Well, by the time I'm at 0.025, if there's a factor of two, it's not really that much bigger. Anyway, also, when I look at the values of the Bindeck cumulants, in fact, the ones for the smallest DTs that I see there are larger than the ones that I could glean from the literature. And larger means that, and you go into larger Bindeck cumulants as the DT gets smaller. So I would suspect that even though I think what other people have done has in general been fairly conservative, there's probably still a significant DT dependence. The thing that I would say saves the people who work at zero chemical potential and people who work at imaginary chemical potential is that you don't have this problem of the thing becoming more difficult and therefore needing a smaller step size as you vary the value of mu. As we go to larger values of mu, we need to cut down our step size because we're getting closer to this boundary where at mu I equals m pi, at which the Dirac operator becomes singular. And that's why we had to have this, there we would have to have one of these explicit symmetry breaking terms. I mean that is very similar to approaching m equals zero. Yes, but the thing about the critical endpoint is because it's in the Ising universality class, it does not have a Goldstone boson associated with it. And therefore, there's no zero mass excitation. So, there's an infinite correlation length. Yeah. No. Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, But the other thing is, of course, that neither the Bielefeld Swansea people nor Philippe and Hervé actually ever go close to this critical endpoint. For example, that Philippe and Hervé are at imaginary chemical potential and they're analytically continuing out to there. The Bielefeld Swansea people are always at zero chemical potential and then they do an expansion to get there. So things are a little bit different even if there are problems associated with critical endpoints. Yes, it is closely linear in DT squared. It's at least the data that we have, and that's the largest one in which we've done the finite DT determinations. Yeah, it's always possible to stick a straight line through it. Of course, that's partially due to the fact that unfortunately, even for these fairly long simulations, and the long simulations, given one of those given points, admittedly some of that's preliminary data, without a typical one of those points would be doing simulations at 3 or 4 betas close to the transition, doing a Fehrenberg-Svensson extrapolation from each of them to the thing, and the typical length for each of those betas would be 160,000 trajectories. So this stuff doesn't come cheaply, even on small lattices. Do what things become for? The T dependence as you go. We're just now starting to do a similar thing at mass, at zero chemical potential, at a mass of 0.03, which is supposed to be clearly first order. Unfortunately, of course, you'd think, ha-ha, clearly first order, I don't have to run quite so long because I don't have critical slowing down. However, of course, I need to see large number of tunnelings, and so that comes out to hurt me. Yeah, crossover, yes, but of course, at that, the one I showed you, the first thing was at mu equals zero, where it's very clearly a crossover, and there's still a considerable, yeah, maybe it means that our DTs are, in fact, significantly larger than everybody else's, but I think that's something that needs to be sorted out. And one of the things that sort of puzzled us at first, and one of the reasons we didn't look too closely at the DT dependence at first, is that, of course, you say, well, the first thing that happens when you change DT, the first order effects of that, or the lowest order effects of changing DT, are just rescaling beta. That's the way to think. Rescaling beta, so that shouldn't change the apparent nature of the transition, except that, of course, it turns out, and this is at mu equals zero, it should be mu sub I equals zero, but and you notice that one thing about the delta betas is that below the transition, delta beta is the effective shift in the beta, measured by measuring the effective beta from using the equipartition theorem on the kinetic energy term in this molecular dynamics. And notice that delta beta, the shift in beta, is much larger below the transition than it is above the transition. And when you fold something like this into a nice formula that's trying to decide what the fluctuations look like, you can very much distort the appearance of the transition. That's in fact what is going on. as dt gets smaller, yeah, it should flatten out. So if you have used one of the exact algorithms, which is probably what we should do in the next stage, it would be totally flat at zero. This is the shift in beta from the input beta to the effective beta for a single step size, but as you vary beta. So below the transition, you get a much larger shift. The effective beta is the beta that you would measure in these hybrid systems by actually looking at the kinetic energy using the equipartition theorem, and then you would find that, you know, equipartition theorem says that every quadratic term in the action should have value, expectation value, a half. If it's a little bit off from that, you figure that what you should do with your Lagrangian is rescale it so those values are a half, and that changes the beta, and that gives you a new beta, and this is the input beta minus that output beta. We were doing this to... But the reason that we were measuring these in the codes is that our codes went back to days when we did microcanonical updating. And with microcanonical updating, you don't put in a beta. You actually have to measure what the beta is by measuring the kinetic energy. That's right.
So this measure is finite.
Yes. Yeah. This is a finite step size, the finite step size error, and what you're seeing is that the finite step size error is quite different below the transition and above the transition, and that's because below the transition. Your conjugate gradient has to work a lot harder. Your Dirac operator is a lot more singular, and so your finite dt effects are a lot larger than above it. Delta beta? Yeah. Okay, let me get rid of this screen. Okay. Yes. Take your typical action. Your action usually, for molecular dynamics, it has what you normally consider SF and then SG. But then, in order to do the dynamics, you put in a term which is sum from alpha equals 1 to 8 of something like a p alpha squared, where p is the momentum conjugate to the gauge field, and you have something, well, it depends on how you do the fermions as to whether you have a fermion piece or not. The fermions you can consider to have either no kinetic energy or no potential energy, two ways of looking at it, because it's just a quadratic term. But, well, if we like, we could put the fermion thing in here and remove it from there, and then we'd have sigma from 1 to 3, and then there would be a pi dagger, which would correspond to the fermion fields. Now, this is a kinetic energy. There are a total of however many, and you know, each of these terms should average to a half over the ensemble. But they don't. They average to something larger than a half, because the energy, things tend to, well, energy is not quite conserved because of finite DT, so things tend to blow up. So that you will find, instead of this being some n times of what, n being the number of degrees of freedom in these, and I, depending on how you count, times the volume times a half. That's what it should be. But it'll turn out, it actually turns out to be something different. So what you want to do is rescale to make this be a half for each degree of freedom. And when you rescale the whole, you can easily rescale the whole action because it doesn't change the equations of motion. But when you rescale, beta here will go to some other beta, beta prime. And the delta beta that I'm plotting is beta minus beta prime. So it is a measure, it's a measure of finite DT effect. And it somehow measures the effective beta as far as the kinetic energy is concerned. Yeah, it's sensitive. It's sensitive. The important thing is not so sensitive, because even there the amounts were small, is that it's very different from one side to the other, and it changes very rapidly from one side of the transition to the other. And that means when you fluctuate a little bit, you actually have to fluctuate. You fluctuate a little bit, you suddenly move your energy, say, down or up, and it makes it more difficult to fluctuate back. So it's when you make it more difficult to fluctuate back and forth, the transition looks more first order. Okay, and then when we finally had a look at how this spin decumulant behaves as a function of mu I squared, we in fact found that instead of what you would like to see if you were going towards a critical endpoint before decreasing with increasing mu I, it actually appears to be increasing. Actually, when you look at it and figure that this piece of data is very preliminary, and this one's still not very high fixed, and that the difference between this and that is only about 3 standard deviations at most, probably that is not yet significant, but it looks a lot flat. It looks, so it's consistent probably with being flat, but it suggests that it may go up, but it doesn't show any sign of a rapid decrease. Now, we believe that in fact the dependence is poorly enough determined at present that we could not rule out the behavior that Philippe and Hervé find, that we could probably rule out the behavior that the Bielefeld-Swansea group find, which I believe has a coefficient that's a couple of orders of magnitude larger than yours, right? Yeah, so. They have not yet put it in. They've not yet put it in a refereed paper. That's true. So they also are confused. What's? On the vertical axis? Why? On the horizontal axis? It would be somewhere beyond. It would be beyond this. Can I get this to go? Yeah. It. Let's see. This corresponds to mu I of 0.3, and I would say that m pi is about 0.4. Look, we've done some simulations at 0.375, and they go very slowly. They require the Dirac operators are obviously becoming fairly singular. You need small step size, and that tells you you're getting close to that boundary. So I would say around 0.4. And this this is 0.2, 0.3 in mu I. No. An exact algorithm is just that. It's one where there are no finite DT errors.
Right.
You know, you might have an acceptance problem. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, you're probably going to have to set your DT fairly small to get a fairly high acceptance. That's true. And how good or bad that is, especially since this will require one of these newer versions of exact algorithms. Oh yeah, I mean there are so obviously, you know, there's good reason why even in this case we ran for 160,000 trajectories. You know, you needed that in order to get a reasonable estimate of the fluctuations, because there are long time constant excitations in this field. If B4 is 1.9, well, what it... No, but the thing is, this is a finite lattice size, so you're looking at what I had drawn on this board, where if you're looking at the way things go, you find that if you're on an 8 cubed by 4 lattice, you know, these points would all be like here. This is 12 cubed by 4, they're up a bit further. If it was 16 cubed by 4, they would probably be up around 2. And if you go to an infinite, if you had an infinite spatial, as you go towards an infinite spatial lattice, only when you're at a critical point, when you're at a crossover or first order transition, they don't. And you'll have seen, if in the typical statistical mechanics literature, these sets of curves which do, you know, like this and then higher and then when you go the furthest you can go, then, of course, this one will be up near 3 and this will be down near 1. Say it's if it's going through an Ising point. But this also corresponds to a crossover, but it's well below 3. But it's just a very small volume. And unfortunately, what we think of as big volumes in the lattice community are actually small volumes. Now, maybe I should... God, how long have we been going? 20 to 5? But anyway, I was just going... Okay, but anyway, yeah, it's... So, clearly, we need to sort out as to whether this is the exact prediction. We were using a mass in this of 0.035 compared with the critical mass 0.033. Perhaps we should go a little bit closer to that. One of the reasons we didn't is that when we before we did this finite DT analysis, our best estimate of the critical mass was 0.034. But now we will probably run at 0.034 to see if things are changing there. If not, then probably we can say that we do not see a sign of a critical endpoint in this theory. Now, whether one can make arguments as to why this theory should be so much different than the thing at finite mu in this regime, this small regime. Now, what you think is that these theories would be very similar in some place where you could basically ignore the fluctuations of the phase of the fermion determinant. Of course, that is a volume-dependent statement. Now, I'm not sure whether doing something like considering something like an epsilon domain, which in this theory, if I can get rid of the screen, in this region would be something like having mu I. Now, in this regime, would be something like having mu I or mu squared V held fixed as V went to and M minus M critical times V held fixed as you go to infinite volume. I don't know whether that makes a lot of sense in these theories, but that would be a regime in which you could probably argue that these two transitions would be identical, because that's the regime it's that type of regime that you would need, since the fluctuation in the determinant goes like mu I, that it would be this type of regime in which your fluctuations of your fermion determinant would be bounded, and if you think that in fact as m goes to mc, the position of this transition goes to zero, then of course if you're making mu I squared scale like 1 over v, you would want to make m minus mc scale like 1 over v. That was just the thought that came to me during Kim's talk. But other than that, it's one of the, and the reason you can't make, it's difficult to make any of these things, these speculations rigorous, is simply because the relationship, any relationship you think of, and saying, well, the fluctuations in the fermion, the phase of the fermion determinant should be small, is of course only something that you can achieve at a finite volume. Now, what I suspect, if this relationship is true, is that instead of the volume being that of importance being the volume that's going to infinity, it would be the volume associated with the volume associated with the typical correlation length. Okay. Anyway, I've pretty well said most of what I was going to say. As I said, it clearly means that we should do some more work here. We need also to think of whether the type of arguments that Philippe makes are relevant to, say, at imaginary mu I as well as at imaginary mu. Remember that system essentially means a system with two chemical potentials, both imaginary. But that we haven't given much thought to. And of course, as I said, all this work is with John Kogut. We'll probably have a write-up of a talk that was given at my workshop last summer, appearing sometime soon. I've actually written up. Philippe had a copy, but since John Kogut hasn't signed off on it, and he's the person who gave the talk, I think I should wait till he's... Well, he'll be here next week when I disappear. Yeah, well, no, he has a copy. He's just been busy with some... Now let's rescue my last transparency. Any more questions? That was the first place where we noted finite DT, and we did some. We went to a smaller DT. We found one DT was too large. We went to as small a DT as we could afford on a 16 cube by 4 lattice, and hoped that was far enough. So I would say it was suggestive, and there are some arguments that were made by Dominique when we were doing two color theories, which are very similar, as to why somewhere on that boundary the transition should become first order. But as I say, I would say that it was suggested. I would not say that it could not be incorrect. You know, we did as I said, we did as best we could, but it's actually, as you could see, not a simple exercise. And probably what we should do, and it's on our to-do list, is actually implement one of these exact algorithms, because that's the only way I know of really being sure that you have the DT behavior under control. Although in these cases it looked like things were linear in the region, linear in DT squared, which is what you would expect for DT small enough. So extrapolating to DT equals zero is not, and it's not too bad. And as I say, we did in fact, get reasonable agreement with Philippe, and that as to the temperature dependence of this transition. And I should leave you with the... leave you with a statement as to... I might as well put an infinite number of irrelevant decimal places in this, but the beta C dependence we found at a mass of 0.035, the beta C dependence we found was 5.1520, no error bars because it's so still very preliminary, 0.194 mu I squared. And if we take the formulae from, or at least one of the choices of formulae we have from their paper, and do this little substitution, change the sign, of course, because we're at real chemical potentials instead of imaginary, what we find is that beta C equals 5.1505. So this is us, and this is them. Minus 0.196 mu I squared. Of course, it's obvious that it won't be quite that good when we get our final results, but as... What was that? No reason. That what? No, but no, except for the argument that maybe in this this is the regime in which you can ignore the fluctuations of the fermion determinant, and if you can fluctuations of the phase of the fermion determinant, if you can do that, then this just corresponds to using a different set of observables. But that's, but of course, you know, of course, as you go to an infinite lattice, the fluctuations become infinite. So that was why I was talking about the potential of some type of epsilon regime. But I don't know if it makes much sense here, because there is another, in your case, you are making all the input masses or mass-like parameters small, and the only thing that was then left that was not being scaled small was lambda QCD. In this case, there is also MC, the critical mass, which is finite, and that's remaining finite, and these other mass like parameters are going to zero. It's the absolute value, yes. That is just a speculation. One doesn't really know. I mean, if you look at the formulae, they're not exactly the same because they differ. And the only place that they're likely to be the same is if the fluctuations of the phase are small.
You're putting an absolute, you're not doing two things.
Yes.
You're doing an integral. An integral is defined by having the set of the polynomial determinants with absolute value.
Yes.
Then it would be resolved.
Well, the absolute value is what we're doing.
So in those pictures here, it could be the same. What you're doing is not the same.
No. Wait, you're saying... I'm not sure exactly what the model you're saying.
Well,
you're saying if... But what I am saying is... No, it's nothing of the sort. If that were true, we would all go home because we'd all have solved it. And oh yeah, but I mean, we take the absolute. That's what we do. That's in fact. That's exactly equivalent to what we do. Is taking the absolute value of the determinant. Yeah, what we do is take the absolute value of the determinant. That's what our theory, the theory we're considering is. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Thank you.